Hello, it's Anna Perrow and Sophie Little here. We run Soundyard and we are the producers of Chris Skinner's Countryside podcast.
We're excited to tell you we've been nominated for an award. It's a public vote, so if you'd like to vote for us, well, that would just be amazing. You can head to norfolkartsawards.org.
Look out for Soundyard. We're under the Broadcast and Media Award, and it's such a pleasure putting the show together and listening with you.
So let's join Chris and Matthew on High Ash Farm.
You're listening to Chris Skinner's Countryside podcast.
Countryside code says always close the gate behind you.
Exactly that. Welcome to High Ash Farm, Matthew. Lovely to see you here.
It's wonderful to be here for the second episode of the Countryside podcast. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. It's a bright morning here in mid-September. And looks like the sun's going to come out again, and we're sort of on the tail of a heat wave, aren't we?
Yes, we are. I don't think I've known such a long period in early September of continuous warmth like we've had. Some of the pastures started to dry off. We're on a field called Caister Park. It's 36 acres, and Caister St Edmund Parish Church is just lurking behind the trees there, and there's the Norwich to Stoke Holy Cross Road, and I can see everybody hurrying off to work. So, we are standing on a really important piece of ground. You can notice it's very flat, slightly sloping down towards the River Tass, which is the other side of Caister Church. And what we didn't know just 10 years ago is we're standing in the middle of the Roman town. Everybody just thought it was in the walled in area, which is just on the other side of the road there. Caister St Edmund Church is actually within the Roman town complex, a Norman building with various additions over the centuries. And underneath us is a complete street plan, with houses, small factories, furnaces, pottery making, and it is an industrial site. And why I like to look back sometimes is you can learn a lot, because that was a complete civilization. Almost 2,000 years ago it started. The Romans came to Caister St Edmund in AD 43, and they were here for 300-400 years or so. And we've yet to find the Roman cemetery. It's here somewhere. Only one or two coffins have ever been found when the railway line was dug on the other side of the valley there in the mid-1800s. A completely sealed lead coffin was found. Obviously, that was a gentry or somebody of high standing.
You talk about the street plan under our feet, though, and there's no evidence at the moment of it, although over the road there, of course, it does look like an enclosure, so that was the clue. But how do we know what's under your feet here?
Because of one of these newfangled devices. It's called GeoPhys, for short. It's a geophysical survey. And what you have is, it's rather like the sat-nav on your car to tell you where you're going. So it locates the little machine on the ground, and that machine sends little electrical pulses down into the ground. And so it prints out a map of an X-ray, if you like, of the soil without having to excavate. And what shocked everybody is, in the past, the street plan used to come up to where the wall, the Roman walls now are. Obviously, there was a lot of upset and a lot of sort of fighting going on. So the Romans enclosed the main bit of the town with a monumental wall, enclosing about nearly 40 acres.
Because the locals were revolting occasionally, weren't they?
No, they were all good-looking people, I'll have you know. But so the locals that were here, we kind of regard them as they're tribal, They're called Celts, and they were here sort of before the Romans occupied this area. So we can go back to BC, actually, before Christ was born. And, of course, we're now 2023 years after that date. But before then, the Iceni, that was the name of the tribe here, lived here and farmed. And we've always thought of them as rather crude, rather uncultured people. But with these new metal detectors underneath us, literally scores and scores of beautiful coins have been found, sometimes in gold, sometimes in silver. And I had to bring one in my pocket.
Oh, God, that's tiny.
This is a Iceni status, and that's the name they gave to their coinage. It's absolutely beautiful. On the obverse side, there's little moon crescents. Can you see those?
Oh, yes. Now you get close, you can see them. Back-to-back moon crescents.
Back-to-back moon crescents.
I mean, it's all the size of, like, less than half an inch across, isn't it?
Yes, about 1.5 centimetres. And then all the way round the periphery are ears of wheat. If I turn it towards you, you're being nibbled by a horse at the moment.
Yes, we're in a horse field these days. No Romans around.
No Romans. And so they obviously, that was hugely important to them. So the moon featured in their life and these ears of wheat. We're now being nibbled by two horses. Now, if I turn it over, this is hugely appropriate. What's on the other side? A horse.
I'm being swished by a tail.
You are now, yes. This is what you get out in the countryside. So I've got some of the status coins, another one in silver, which has come out of the way. Not you, Gudgeon, this horse. It's been a bit cheeky. The other one has got a hare on the obverse side. So obviously they were important. But you can see they certainly weren't crude people to have coinage like this. And status is what they were called. And still, if you've got status today, you've got kind of standing in society.
So how old do you think that coin is? That's a tiny coin.
It's been dated as BC 57. So absolutely, it's been to the Norwich Castle Museum. I found it on this field chopping out sugar beet, and when it was ploughed many years ago, it's back to pasture now.
And it shows the sophistication. The moon was so important to the people back then, wasn't it? They realised even then how important the moon was for tides and weather.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot more we don't know. It's called the Iron Age back then, so there's two Iron Age settlements on High Ash Farm, and much later on the Romans came, and then on top of the hill behind us there is an Anglo-Saxon cemetery. Equally beautiful artifacts left there. So, as I said, it's a really important and historic era in our time. Then the Romans came, and again, we know they made sophisticated pottery. Here at the farm, lots of old broken pots have been found when they do the excavations. I think you've got polos or something in your pocket. Other sweets are available, but that one's this horse. I'm not sure of its name, actually, because there's several here at the farm. It's taken a really...
It's friendly, though, isn't
very,
it?
Hopefully it's friendly. It's going to under your shoelaces now.
Oh, bless his heart.
And the other thing that I found on this field is a beautiful Roman brooch, which I've also in my pocket.
Look at that. Looks like it could have just been minted yesterday, that.
Look at that. It's a dome shape, still with the clasp working perfectly on the other side.
It looks brand new, doesn't it?
And it's inlaid with red and blue enamel. And I think any lady going to a smart party would wear that, and you'd have lots of comments even today. So you can start to learn a lot about that culture that's been here and long gone. You're being licked by... Oh, come out of the way, you. Go on, out.
I think you've heard about gate crashing and...
Yes, I have.
Hogging the limelight.
No, it's because they're trying to share the flies with us, which are a bit of a nuisance around their faces. Some of them have fly masks on here, the horses this is, and so they'll stand next to you, or they'll swish their tails over you and to try and swish the flies off. But there we are. So there's a lot of lessons here, that there's two whole cultures that have been here. It was their home, and they've been and gone. And this is one of the few sites in the United Kingdom of a complete Roman town that hasn't been built on by subsequent development. Lots of the Roman wall that fortified the enclosed bit of the town, the Roman town, on the other side of the road there has been almost levelled to ground level, and that was used to build Norwich City Wall. So it's almost like the town moved several miles to the, where the centre of Norwich now is, and parts of that wall are still there. And I used to sort of sit and look at it at Brackendale School when I was at school in the 1960s. So there we are, a bit of history been and gone, but it helps us today to understand what the people did and how sophisticated they were back then. But we don't know all the reasons why those cultures have gone. And there's a lesson for us, I think, today.
Well, thousands of years of English countryside history, and it's all wrapped up in this square mile that Chris farms here in 2023. And as part of the podcast, Chris has been introducing us to the history, but also the natural history.
Yes.
For new listeners as well. And that's where we're moving next.
That is just a few steps, and I'm going to show you something I don't think you've ever seen before.
Got some rooks in fine voice this morning, and Chris has sort of led the way over to the other side of the field here, and we've got these big horse troughs, haven't we?
Yes, these are water for the horses at the grass livery here. There's no main supply, so we clean the tanks out twice a year and refill them with clean water. And after a few days, this is what happens. We've got bright green water because under the farm we have a chalk layer, and chalk kind of is almost like a feedstuff in the water, if you like, for certain plants. Very crude plants, single-celled plants called algae. And this is why you've got this pea soup green water.
It literally is not, I mean, it's not what I'd want to drink, I have to
there,
say.
I'm going to get a double handful. And you can see in my hand it is quite green. And because of the chalk in the water, it kind of feeds the algae. Now, what's important about algae, although this looks like green pea soup, is that it's a kind of foundation. The little algae have something called chloroplasts in their structure. That means they can manufacture energy from sunlight. Yeah, so it's one of the ingredients of life, chlorophyll. Here, so that's what you're looking at. If you like to look at it as, you know, when cattle graze grass, or in the winter months snails and slugs climb up trees and eat the algae on the side of tree trunks that face southwards, that's called Pleurococcus. That's another algae. And this one is sort of 2 feet deep of a horse pasture, if you like. It's like grass growing in water, it's the best way to describe it. So it's a foodstuff, all right? And it's really valuable for some of our insects and plants. Now, some birds carry insects in their feathers when they come and have a drink, and they dip their heads in the water and some of the insects can drop off in the water. And that's exactly what has happened with the next water tank. Each one holds 1,000 gallons of water. Both tanks are pretty well full. So, Matthew, here's the surprise. Walk a few steps that way to the next tank. A little bit further.
Ooh,
there's one. And have we got another one in front of us? Yes, there.
You've got lots of brown dots circling in a clockwise, no, anti-clockwise way, haven't you? There?
Yes, you couldn't make this up. And look at this. There's one now going to form here. It's just forming as we watch. These are cyclops. They are, right, if you go back into Greek mythology, there were one-eyed giants depicted in a lot of statues. They didn't have any eyes at all apart from one in the centre of the head. And these little insects, called water fleas, cyclops is their correct name, do something unusual at this time of the year. Can you see the difference in colour between this tank and the one we just looked at? It's not green anymore.
Yeah, that's right. It's gone to a more like a sort of dingy, sort of darker colour,
hasn't
it?
Well, it's much clearer. And look over there.
I suppose the dinginess is actually what the tank's made out of.
The tank, yes, yeah. So you can almost see the bottom now. And they have grazed this pasture, this aerial plankton in the water, if you like. And look here. just down at this end of the tank. They're now swarming today. It's what they do just one or two days in the whole year. So you're witnessing something, an important part of their life story.
So there are clouds of them in the water. They are tiny. They're their brown colour, and they're swooshing around, aren't they, as
yep.
well?
Yeah, and there's one are now forming a little cyclone. That one's going in a clockwise direction quite fast. And can you see it's pulling in all the others once they swim round? And in the centre of that little cyclone, it's like looking at a weather forecaster's map of a hurricane, looking down on the world, and you can see these swirls, and then almost a still bit in the centre, and that is where the mating's happening. Just there, they're pulling it in from the edge. You can see they're being pulled in, ropes of them coming in, another one forming there, little swirls.
That's just anticyclonic, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that one is anticyclonic. Sometimes it's one way, sometimes it's the other way.
And all the things in the water, dead flies, or even some of the living, the water boatmen, they're all getting caught up in this current.
Yes, exactly that. So it's a hugely exciting time. And what happens is the water has warmed from the last day or two with the intense sunshine we've had. Normally these little water fleas. There's two. There's Cyclops here, which is the ones we're looking at, and a slightly darker version, slightly larger, called Daphnia as well. Now, these are crucial to sort of wildlife tapestry, biodiversity, because this is the main food of things like dragonfly larvae. They will feed on those. Dragonfly larvae are carnivorous. There's great diving beetle in this tank, and occasionally if we're watching you'll see a huge green beetle come up to the top and go open its little wing cases, takes in some air, and then go back to the bottom, and it's feeding on those. And of course all our fish species absolutely love these. It's just an amazing sight. It just, you know, you just miss it if you walk past. It's just a water tank with water in, and yet it's a foundation of many other species.
And the tank's only a few feet by a few feet, but how many do you think are in there?
I should think 8 to 10 million. Yes, more than the population of London. Look at it. I mean, it is like soup, not from the green algae.
So will they transmit themselves into the next pool?
Yeah,
there?
Because when a horse comes in to drink this water, it will have a foo left on its muzzle. So whichever tank they drink on, look, just beginning to happen in the green tank. They're going even faster in their circular motion.
Because there's more food in
because
there.
Because there's more food. These have nearly eaten themselves out of house and home, and that's why they're mating, because it's the end of their life cycle. The females, once they're mated, lay eggs, but they don't deposit the eggs on the bottom of the tank in any mud, although these tanks are clean. They have two little egg sacs each side of their body. It looks like they're carrying a satchel to school, and there can be 20 or 30 eggs each side of these little cyclops. But they have one eye only in the centre of the top of their head. That's why they're called cyclops. And and we just think it's a very rudimentary organ. It can tell the difference between day and night, and that's about it.
These are really boiling up now in the old tank, aren't they? It looks like they're boiling up from the bottom of
yes,
the
yes, and there's as many down at the bottom which haven't yet joined the mating throng, and so as the morning goes on, the water will warm up a little bit more, although it's quite warm. If I just put my hand in it, it's not actually cold, but if I just do that, just look on my hand, it is absolutely covered.
We'll get close to them, have a look.
Yep.
Yes, so you can see them, can't you? I can't see the one eye, though.
They've got a tiny... No, it's too small. You need a little microscope or a handheld lens. And so I'll just pop my hand in the other tank, and that's what the horses would have done naturally. And that's what... So this tank, in about a week's time, will be clean, but their mating year will be over. So they will... Most of those that we're looking at die. They sink to the bottom of the tank, and then they become food for other crustaceans. They are crustaceans themselves, so they've got larger cousins like crabs and lobsters as well, all part of that family. And so there we are. It's a sight that you have to wait another year to come back here and see. Just absolutely stunning.
8 million water flea. Cyclops.
And not an itch in sight. It's just a wonderful spectacle. That's all you can say.
We're in the farm pickup and we're going along one side, one of the fields of wildflowers and all the wonderful plants here that's so good for the birds in particular in the winter, but the insects enjoy all this as well, the teasels.
Yes, I've been harvesting teasel seed this week, Matthew. I grow a few patches out on the farm and like yellow rattle, which is really difficult to harvest, I've managed to learn the trick of harvesting teasel seed without a combine. It's one of those trade secrets, and that enables me to sell some of the seed off the farm, and I just send some samples off to various wildflower merchants, and it fetches a really good price as well, but it's quite an art form. But the crop you're looking at is just several crops. This is overwinter wild bird seed mix.
Oxeye daisy?
Yes, there's some oxeye daisy, there's sunflower there, lots of borage, and triticale, which is just coming into flower. That's one of the cereal species. You can see little white anthers hanging off each ear. And there's spring barley in there as well.
It's really grown up, isn't it? Yes. I mean, some of it's 6 foot tall.
Yes, it's pretty tall. And that's beautiful. Look at that Wedgwood blue one right beside us. That is chicory.
Chicory,
if you remember, there's a pop group called Chicory Tip, I seem to remember.
Son of my father.
Exactly. And also, it was an ingredient in coffee, which I think you can still purchase today.
Oh, yes, that stuff that was like a concentrate.
Yes, it was. Yeah. And to add sort of some piquance to the flavour, to make it a bit more bitter, they added chicory, and it was called Camp Coffee, I think, way back then. I just remember the bottle. My mum used to make fabulous coffee cake, coffee sponge cake.
I remember a great old colleague of ours years ago, Tom Edwards. You remember Tom?
Oh, of course.
Tom,
yes.
a great radio disc jockey on network radio and pirate radio in the 60s. And he used to have to mention Camp Coffee on his programme because it was an advert, you see.
Oh, I see.
And his catchline was, if it's coffee, it's got to be camp.
Oh, wonderful. Right, I'm going to stop the car because this is an amazing sight in front of us. Let me just put the handbrake on, turn the engine off, and let's have a little look at what we're seeing.
I love the sunflowers here. They're beautiful, aren't they? It's lots more than I could see the other side.
Yes, and this is a real favourite for the birds. It's one I've just started to grow. It's perennial sow thistle. Tall plant, it's a good 4 feet tall, and it's just shedding its seed, as all the thistle family does. I'll just pull a little handful of the little pappus off the top, and you can see all the seeds in the tips of my finger there. Beautiful, and lots of bird species love that. Linnets adore it. Sunflower there, about to come out into flower. Borage here, some people call it star flower. Just look at the centre of the little flower.
Oh, the perfect star, as a child would draw a star.
Yes, and a little black tip to the flower as well. Lots of other plants. Phacelia there, just about finished flowering, and once the sun's out again in a few minutes, this will be buzzing with bees, and already the first flocks of linnets are descending on this crop. Bumblebee over there looking for some pollen and nectar, and there's a tall species of grass here, also produces lots of seed, just finished flowering, and it's really beautiful. It looks rather like a cigarette, I suppose, about that length and about that size, and it's called canary grass, and it produces masses of tiny little white seeds in about 2 to 3 weeks' time, and because it's such a rigid species of grass, it will stand through into the winter months, and that enables birds to perch on it, even if you get a fall of snow or something like that. And there's some of the seed I've managed to force out. Bright white seed, about the size of, you know, what my father used to feed his canaries on. He had Norfolk and Norwich canaries in the farmhouse, and it was a great hobby back then.
It's not one you've carried on, though.
Yeah, no. Mine are all flying free. But what I've really brought you here to see is just on the other side of this track. The far side of the track is a 4 metre margin, especially for harvest mice and small rodents. And this year we have the most amazing crop of berries that I have seen in years. The first one we come to is a tall, tall plant, Rosa canina, and it was right up at the top of this hedge, which is about 12, 15 feet tall, and it's dropped out onto the side of the track a bit. And these, look at these beautiful bright orange berries. I'll pull one off.
Are they rose hips?
Exactly that. Oh. Good, you're getting... I was going to see if you could knew what they were.
I remember because of the syrup, of course.
Of rose course, syrup. And I was brought up on that. I was one of the first National Health babies in the late 1940s when I was born, 74 years ago now. And rose hip syrup was an ingredient very rich in vitamin C. And the plants are really clever because I spend each day of my life on this farm, and the plant starts off and comes into flower, and you have these gorgeous pink flowers. The flower is a symbol of Tudor Britain, in fact, and it's really beautiful, very delicate, very simple, but its function is to attract insects to it to get the little seed that's going to be underneath it pollinated, and then you can produce this berry later in the year. Now, the plant's job is completely different. It's, instead of attracting insects to it, it's got to attract birds. So it's produced these berries, and I'm going to bite into this one.
Lovely russet red berry.
There we go. And inside are, what, the best part of 20 seeds in there. The flesh is edible to birds. Now, these little berries in the centre here, these little seeds, are extremely hard when another week or two when they're fully ripened. I'm just going to squeeze the top half of it out, and out they all pop on my fingers. Now, they have a rock-hard coating on them. Birds don't have teeth, so they swallow these berries whole. Things like winter-visiting thrushes, like fieldfare, redwing, our own thrush species here, blackbirds, and even song thrushes will eat them, as well as pigeons and starlings. And they have little bits of grit in their gizzard, so although they don't have teeth, they have to grind up the outside coating of the berry, the little fruit here. So that is where all the nutrition is. But the plant doesn't want the bird to eat its seeds. It wants them to pass through unharmed. So this hard coating on the seed passes right through the bird, and it rubs off some of that hard coating on the seed. Then the bird goes to roost somewhere else, maybe in this hedge, maybe in woodland. And obviously it comes out the other end, it poops onto the woodland floor somewhere near a shrub if the bird's roosting in the shrub, and that's the ideal spot for the next generation of rose, to wild rose, if you like, to grow up. Rosa canina, the dog rose. Now, next one is our famous hedging plant, hagthorn, it was called in Saxon times. And have you ever seen anything like this before?
It's festooned with red berries, yeah. Smaller and rounder than the rose hips, but this is hawthorn?
This is hawthorn. This is common hawthorn, this particular one. And you can tell common hawthorn. There's two species of hawthorn in the UK. Common hawthorn, this one. And if I take a leaf off, you can see the leaf is deeply serrated. There's three or four, looks like somebody's been into the leaf with a pair of scissors all the way around the periphery of the leaf. So that's English hawthorn. Midland hawthorn doesn't have those ribs, and there's also a difference in the haws. That's the name of these berries that we're looking at. It's an amazing sight. I should think on High Ash Farm this year we got between 75 and 100 tonnes of hawthorn berries and hedges. They are absolutely draped. This goes all the way down, and you don't need much of this. Remember, we're just looking at one side. Matthew, they're up on the top and they're down the other side as well. So,
I mean, this hedge really is a supermarket, a food shop par excellence for the wildlife, isn't it? There's blackberries here and there's ivy as well, which is now coming into flower.
Yes, yep, it's all happening. And so I know DEFRA is having a consultation at the moment about the future management of hedgerows on farm, and there's a lot of controversy because you have something on farms that you have what's called a no-cut period, which is from the end of August to March, and during that period you are allowed to cut your hedges, and of course the labour isn't on the farms anymore. You can imagine if I gave you a sickle or a pair of shears, I said, Mr. Gudgeon, we're going to do Kemp's East Hedge today. It's just 200 metres long, that's all. There's 5 years growth on this one, and I don't know how far you'd get in making a good job of it and trimming it. And
I have enough trouble with my own garden hedge, let alone this one.
People don't want to do that anymore, so we've designed these flail machines so you can sit in the tractor and do quite a nice, neat job of it. But the last thing I'd want to do is to cut all these berries off. So
it would be a criminal shame, wouldn't it, to do that, because there's so much food here for the birds, and it's such a lovely sight as well.
Absolutely, yes. So it's really perfect. And this one is just, if I pull one down, we might actually see some in here.
Oh, hang on, I recognise these. Yes, because these are rather good with high-strength, export-strength gin, aren't
they? That's right, yes, they're sloes. That's a fruit of Prunus spinosa. It's the blackthorn. And it's called blackthorn because if you look into the hedge and look at some of the stems, they have a blackish sort of colour to the stalks, although many of them are covered in algae as well.
Got this bloom on them, haven't they?
That's right.
Gunmetal grey.
That means they're ready to pick. I can just rub my finger on one, and they're closely related to our garden plums. They're actually not called berries. They're called droops is the proper name. I think I was called that at school, or was that a drip? I'm not sure. But they're droops is the correct name. So there's a fleshy coat, and then the seed is within there, and plums are the same. So there we are. So just a living corridor for birds and small mammals to get about the countryside, and really important to sort of form the patchwork landscape of our countryside. And that's why I think we have to look after hedges with everything we can do. They're hugely important. If you want farmland birds, tall little trees growing down the hedge like this for yellowhammers to sing from, and also brilliant for nesting in, almost impenetrable in there, so birds like sparrowhawks can't get in and capture the small birds. So it serves a huge amount of functions and just improves biodiversity if they're properly managed.
Well, as the year goes on and we carry on with our podcasts every week, you'll hear a lot more about the bird life who arrive at High Ash Farm. Some of them leave as well. We'll have the swallows leaving soon. But there's huge variety of birds. And some people say, oh, Chris Skinner's lucky, all these birds coming along. They always perform for him. There's no luck involved. It's managing what you've got here, this hedge and others around and the fields. It's managing that habitat, isn't it, that gets the birds in?
Absolutely, yes. You have to think what they need and then try and provide it. It's not easy. It's not in a lot of farmers' natures to do it, but it is necessary for biodiversity and for the future of our planet. Just look down that hedge. Have you ever seen anything like that? It is draped. It is an amazing sight.
Well, we welcome feedback on the programme. Tell us about what you've seen in the Norfolk countryside or elsewhere further afield, anywhere in the world. Get in touch with the podcast and we'll look forward to future episodes.
Hello, I'm Anna.
And I'm Sophie.
We're from Soundyard and we produce Chris Skinner's Countryside Podcast.
Firstly, we just wanted to say thank you so much for all of your lovely messages and support for the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Now, it's our mission to make sure that no one is excluded from hearing this podcast. And that's why we've set up a CD service to post out each episode to people that might not have access to the internet.
If you know someone in that situation, have them give us a call and leave a message on 01603 273 899.
In the near future, Chris and Matthew will be answering questions in the studio. So if you'd like to get in touch with one, then you can email chris@countrysidepodcast.co.uk.
And don't forget, if you want to support Chris and Matthew, you can by leaving a review wherever you're listening.
And if you want to find out more about us, we're at soundyard.org. See you next week.